Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
On this week's Media Project, we're going to talk about candidates and public officials who have all kinds of problems, including drug abuse, and we'll look into how that works. Hello, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo. Howdy.
Hello.
And publisher Ira Fussfeld, sir.
Hello again.
Dr. Shartok is not with us, which means that the people who are hearing this show for the first time on WEIU in Charleston, Illinois, do not know about Alan
Shartok.
Don't
know. What a surprise you are in for.
So come back
enjoy.
Next week. Yeah. Missing the voice that does, of course, dominate our airwaves. But not if we have a choice. So listen, since we last met, there was an election, and suddenly the next day, or even that night, there's immediately talk about what this means for presidential politics. Do we have to? I mean, this is 2013. The next presidential election is 2016.
I'm taken by the fact that many people in this country, including many people in the media, bemoan the never-ending election cycle, and it's too much. And why don't we do it the way they do it in other countries, where they set aside 6 weeks or whatever it is, and that's the campaign? And yet the coverage has picked up steam, particularly with Chris Christie's big victory the other night. And the question that I have is, are we in the media guilty of fomenting this, or are we just simply covering what's out there? And that, in fact, this is what people in the political circles are talking about.
Yeah, I think this is action that we cover. It's fun, and Americans are more into their politics, or at least the horse race part of it, than Europeans. And I'm glad that I love listening to political analysts pull apart what's happening and what it all means. It's not just Christie. It's here in New York, too. They're all analyzing, what did the election mean for Andrew Cuomo's chances? He has to get elected governor again before he can make a run for president. And they're pulling apart what it means that Western New York voted the way it did for his presidential election. It's fascinating.
Do you agree with that?
No.
I keep thinking of when a comedian tells a joke after a tragedy, and then he'll say, too soon? And I just, is this too soon to be doing this?
I just think that it's distraction. Yes, people find it entertaining. Some people do.
Distraction from what?
From the issues that are really fundamental that we ought to be talking about. You know, I mean, it really is like sports are more fun than substance, but government is about substance. It's about getting things done.
And yet you would stop coverage of politics and keep on with the sports, Rex.
I would keep on with this. What do you mean? I would not.
If you had the choice, you're granted great power. Tomorrow, you could pull either your sports pages or your political page to put coverage of whatever mythical issue you think we don't cover. Which would you pull? Come on, it wouldn't be sports.
I don't know. I mean, why do we put news on the front page and sports not very often?
Increasingly, we don't. We put sports there, too.
A little bit.
Well, I've always thought the analogy to sports is when I was a sports writer and then I moved over to the news side and people asked me what it was like. And I said, well, you know, covering election day is like covering a locker room after a baseball game. The only difference is when you interview the participants, they're all clothed. And I just think that the political writing establishment.
Those were the days, by the way. You know, nowadays politicians also expose themselves.
Are less clothed.
But go right ahead. Yeah. Anyway,
only
sorry.
If they're in a drunken stupor.
He was an American.
I that's true. I just think that the political writers, it's an easy beat in that it's much like sports writers. There are participants and there's the game and there are winners and losers. And it's very easy to judge things that way without getting into the minutia of what the real issues are in the campaign. And part of that is because we don't think that our readers are willing to tolerate big, long position papers.
The reporters aren't.
But then that being said, are our readers and listeners also willing to tolerate discussion about the 2016 presidential election the day after the 2013 off-year election? It just seems entirely
too long. Well, it actually was the day after the 2012 election. I mean, I heard political analysis on the morning after the 2012 election about Andrew Cuomo's 2016 race, and he is certainly running, said the analyst. And it just seems to me that that's absolutely not true. We certainly do not know that so-and-so is running.
Well, they had a poll already that despite Chris Christie's huge win in New Jersey, a poll of New Jersey voters said that if it was Chris Christie versus Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton would win by 4 points. I
mean, that's interesting.
Why? It's three. It's meaningless. On November 6, 2013, Hillary would win. But tell me, get back to me in November 2016.
And we will. We'll be covering it all along, Ira.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to happen. I guess I just don't know whether this is being generated by us, the greater us, because we have either nothing else to do or we think people are interested. Or, in fact, there is real news here. I'm not sure there is real news here yet. I think this is all self-generated news.
Well, where there is real news, of course, is Toronto. See, this is what in radio is known as a segue.
That was good.
Thank you. It was very smooth.
Yeah, Rex.
Yeah, very smooth. Yes. Had to point it out. So anyway, in Toronto, of course, the great story is Rob Ford. Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, who in fact has conceded now, yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. Whoa.
Amazing.
Which, of course, had been reported by the media up there, notably the Toronto Star, for months ahead while he denied it.
Since May is when the reporters in Toronto first saw this video of the mayor in a drunken stupor with a bunch of thugs in an Ethiopian neighborhood smoking crack. And the people who did the recording wanted to sell it for a great deal of money. So there's big ethical concern about buying it. They didn't buy it, but they looked at it and reported on it. Gawker did the same. I love the role of Gawker in this.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of leapfrogged.
They totally leapfrogged and then held a crowdsourcing fundraiser. You know what those are, where they say, help us raise $200,000 so we can buy the video and show it to you. They actually raised the money. I love that angle of the story. The mayor and his brother, who's a city councilman, what a family that is, a city councilman, have harangued the press for months now. In fact, even when the story was breaking, the brother, Doug Ford, was in a journalism school talking about the rotten maggot-like journalists who
keep digging
at the story when there was nothing there. And, of course, it was there. So most of the coverage of this, and that's what I'd like to hear you guys talk about, is how we do this routinely. Of course, you're going to keep digging at a story like that, covering it as if it were a presidential race. Month after month,
This was the here and now, not 3 years later.
This was really amazing. And they just kept chipping away at it until they got out the whole story. There have been, you know, lots of stuff about this, about the investigation, about the mayor's other substance abuse problems.
And it matters. This is the fourth largest municipal government in North America, $10 billion a year budget. So the guy who runs that government is, by accounts that I've read, something of a thug in terms of the way he deals with people. But he's an enormous personality. He's much loved by the blue-collar element of the electorate who propelled him into this job. And people like the fact that he was pushing around reporters. You know, the way they took advantage of that hatred
for reporters. It made them sympathetic to him. It made the public sympathetic to him.
You have to give the reporters credit because it's awfully difficult to be in a situation like that when you're making a report and to continue to dig and stand your ground, even in the face of the politician and perhaps public opinion saying, get away, you guys are off base here.
You know, I actually disagree a bit with that because this story is so huge and must have been such an incredible high to be reporting on it. At one point, their editor says to them, do not get into a car with any of these guys asking for the money, the thugs, if we can call them. They're kind of basically blackmailing the mayor. He said, do not get in a car with them. Stay in touch with me at all times. And the thugs say, if you want to see this video, it's on a cell phone. leave your cell phones here, leave your bags here, and get in this car and come with us. Ooh. And they did it in a minute. Violated all safety rules, which, you know, I'd like to think I would have done too. But they were so high on this. This is why people are reporters. It's a rush to get a story like this.
Don't you think?
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is a dangerous thing. You know, I remember I had very small forays into foreign reporting when I was a young reporter at Newsday, and I was going down into the Civil War zone in Central America. I remember the foreign editor saying to me, sitting me down, because I was a young reporter without experience in international reporting, really, and he said, "I want you to know that you are not authorized to risk your life." He said, "You are not, Newsday does not want you to do anything dangerous. You are not to do anything dangerous. You are to come back here all in one piece." Yeah. And of course, that day, the day before I left, I was wearing a sort of olive drab shirt. I thought it looked cool. And he said, "And you are never to dress like that when you're out." You know, years ago, during the Korean War, for example, during the Vietnam War even, reporters were issued fatigues right. with their name on it. I mean, God. They looked like military. Yeah, can you imagine that?
Famous coverage by Morley Safer in Vietnam, and he was dressed like an army officer. Right. The thing about Toronto, the non-media element of this that I just find hilarious, is that when the mayor admitted to smoking crack, he says he doesn't do it all the time, but I must have been in this drunken stupor. I
mean, as if it was an excuse.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the drunken stupor admission alone ought to put his mayoralty
Well, remember Wilbur Mills, our own...
Dancing down with, well, I forget, was
Fanny
it?
Fox.
Fanny Fox.
Yeah, the Argentine firecracker. Yeah.
That's it. Oh, wow. She ends up in the tidal basin, and he's saying, "Yeah, but, you know, I was drunk."
I was drunk.
What'd you expect?
Of course.
Really.
Interesting.
And the guy's still mayor. That's the part of the story that kills me. So much for the power of the press.
And when he's held to account by reporters saying, "But you lied to us during all this time," he said, "Well, you didn't ask the correct question."
Yeah.
Well, for the record, many times he was asked, "Have you ever smoked crack cocaine?" And when he finally admitted it, "Well, you didn't ask the right question." This kind of arrogance is fairly outrageous.
And to Rosemary's point, he is still mayor, but it's only been a couple of days since the admission. Is there any indication that there's going to be a groundswell against him now?
I don't know, but Elliot Spitzer didn't wait more than a couple days when he was having his own little scandal problem. He got out of town right away. Yeah. How come this guy doesn't? Yeah.
I think it is important when you note the fact that the reporters were very careful, as you were saying, about this in terms of not reporting more than they knew. You know, we had a situation in our community where we had a member of Congress who allegedly beat up his wife, and we got word of that immediately after it happened. And this was in January of 2008, if I'm recalling correctly. And he denied it immediately when we called him. But we had strong law enforcement sources who said to us, "Yes, this did happen." We decided we couldn't publish the story until we had a document, until we got a piece of paper so that we could actually see the file. Everybody involved with the supposedly involved with it, we tracked down the cops who were supposedly sent to the scene. No, this didn't happen. But we had sources that we trusted, who we knew were telling us the truth. Mm-hmm. We had finally three oral sources. It wasn't until, frankly, Halloween, the weekend before the actual election for Congress, that we were given finally the piece of paper, the document that showed the truth. And we decided to publish the story. I remember actually being on the phone in my car driving from Syracuse back to Albany saying, "Yes, let's go with the story." This involved then Congressman John Sweeney saying, "Okay, let's publish online." We published it at 9 p.m. and at 9:30 p.m. the New York Daily News published the story. They apparently have been given the same document at the same time. So I'm glad we beat them by a half hour. But he still denied it. He still had a press conference the next day denouncing us and saying we were out to get him. And somebody leaked a fake document to a local TV station that hadn't been on the story at all, and they immediately went forward saying the Times Union incorrectly reported and we have the true story here. And it wasn't until many months later, of course, that we found out that it was true.
And the default position for politicians is to say the newspaper got it wrong, the media got it wrong.
Or they're out to get
them.
It seems to me, and I want to see if you agree, that in the last, I'll say decade, maybe a little longer than that, the public is more willing to accept that as, in fact, the case than it might have accepted it decades ago, because we, the media, are not seen as credible as a collective as we used to be. So if somebody says, oh, it's the media's fault, well, yeah, I believe that.
Mm-hmm. Sad but true,
yeah.
I think.
And that's our fault to a certain extent.
And this happens all the time. Out in San Diego last week, a candidate for mayor named Kevin Falconer had a spokesman who refused to answer a question from a reporter because he said, you know, your boyfriend's bias.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. The boyfriend is an IT guy, I guess, something like this.
But he did a lot of Twitter. That's why the spokesman knew how he felt allegedly about various issues.
Right. But for refusing to answer an entirely valid question about a public position, a position on immigration, which is an important issue for a mayoral candidate in San Diego, refusing to answer what the candidate would say about this issue, allegedly because of a reporter's boyfriend's bias. Interesting.
Yeah. He later apologizes, too, for that.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing. So this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you're just joining us, or if you're some of those nice folks in Charleston, Illinois, hearing this show for the first time on WEIU, welcome. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. Rosemary Armeo is a journalism professor at UAlbany, and Ira Fussfeld, longtime newspaper publisher in the Hudson Valley of New York, from which this program originates. Beautiful area here, folks, if you haven't been here. Chilly, wet. In any case,
I grew up here, Rex, and I don't believe you.
It's a wonder. So let's travel. Think about travel journalism, which has for years been an area of, let's say, a gray area ethically. And one of the bright lights in that was some years ago, Condé Nast Traveler had what they called truth in travel. That has always been a fundamental of Condé Nast Traveler, that they would say people contributing to its pages, who are often freelancers, pay the same price as you do. They travel unannounced, except in rare cases where it's impossible to do so. It's like restaurant reviews. Mm-hmm. You know, your restaurant critic, you hope, is anonymous, is not familiar to the restaurant, so you get a fair vision of what's really going on. Now, suddenly, apparently, Condé Nast Traveler has abandoned this policy.
Yeah, it's not sudden and it's not surprising. It's an economy move. They don't want to pay for these expensive trips anymore, so they'll take help from hoteliers.
Speaking of credibility, their credibility now will be in question, because anytime, even if it's the most honest journalist going on one of these junkets to review a resort, people are going to start from the premise that they're not going to write a bad review because they were on the lam for that whole time. Is it on the lam?
Or
on
their, no, that would be on, if you're,
yeah,
they're fleeing.
From you're the both. No, they're on their dime.
On the take. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, on the take.
It's a good thing.
I think people thought we did this anyway. I think they think that we get our way paid into movies, into plays for reviewing, and food. I don't think they get the idea that there's a difference between not paying and paying your own way.
Well, and there's also a culture that has evolved through places on the internet like Yelp, where people can write reviews, and now it's being established people are writing their own reviews, either negatively against competition or favorably about themselves. So it calls into question even the most objective review.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
The Attorney General of New York is investigating this to see whether businesses are in fact paying for these alleged independent citizen reviews. And it does show to a certain extent the limit of something that we all recognize as being a reality in the media world these days, and that is the rising power of citizen-generated content, reader-generated content. There is a limit to that when you have the independence in question there, right?
You know, that's really interesting. I've been for a couple of years now enthusiastic contributor to TripAdvisor, which is one of these citizen-generated reviews of hotels and destinations. And I put in something from a place in Brazil. And for the first time, I got a questionnaire back from TripAdvisor asking if I had paid my own way, if a company had paid for it, if I had received any gifts from the place that I was writing about. And, you know, the answer to all of that was no. But it was interesting that I'd never been asked that before.
And if, in fact, you had been and the answer was no, there'd be no way of them knowing that.
Very good point.
Yeah.
Do you think the question was content-based? Did you write a favorable review?
This was a favorable review, and it actually is odd for me because I usually wait until I really hate something to test it and then blast them, you know, on TripAdvisor. So this was out of character, but it'll be interesting. It made me wonder if they had also written to the place, like, look at this review we got. Do you know this person? Did you give them anything?
Uh-huh.
So you have to believe that, and I have to because I'm on the business side, and Rosemary and Rex might be a little more skeptical, but if Condé Nast Traveler must realize that its credibility is going to now be called into question on the very core of what it is they're doing, and if their finances are such that they have to do it this way now, they are really rolling the dice, and they're saying we're running the risk of blowing the rest of the franchise as a result of this, or we're hoping that people will still believe in us, that despite the fact that we're taking free room ruin board that people are going to be objective in their coverage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I read a lot of travel stuff, and it's hard for me to think if someone told me the hotel paid our way, they gave us a double. If you came, you'd have to spend the same. You'd have to spend this amount for the same I got. Would I believe it any less? You talk to travel writers, and they invariably will say, well, you know, just because they paid my way, I just tell you what I really think anyway. I don't know if that's true. I don't immediately disbelieve it. So maybe the credibility is in mm-hmm. our eyes. We worry so much about that.
As we should, you know, it really is difficult sometimes to remain independent. In my youth, I dated a restaurant critic. And at this newspaper that I worked at, the critics had to go 3 times to each restaurant mm-hmm. incognito because you didn't want to go just once because you
could
might get an off
night
for the chef. And my job was to steal a menu each time.
Well, what a great deal this is. Here's Rex who is courting a young lady who's the restaurant. So they go out to dinner and it doesn't cost him a dime. What a great, because it's
and good deal for her too, because she doesn't have to cook.
And she doesn't have to eat everything. She's got a sampler too. This is the thing. You get to try these things. It actually gets old. People don't think this, but you know, if you have to go out every night of the week, it becomes kind of a burden.
Oh, I'm feeling great sympathy.
especially when you're in Manhattan going to the 4 or 5 star restaurants.
Well, yeah, it was a little of that. But people, I think, don't understand that. And now in our environment at the Times Union, we have two things that are different that you know are not the way that a larger publication would approach it. First, we send somebody who we hope is incognito, who we hope is not known, to the restaurant only once. And we say in the little blurb with this thing, this is based upon a single unannounced visit. Your experience may be different. The second thing we do is that if it is going to be a slam review of a place that has a good reputation, we'll say, you know, wait a minute, go back another time. If this person has a terrible experience at some place that is supposed to be good, we'll say, give it another shot, because you could, even if that costs us more, we recognize that we could really be having a bad time. And then we'll go ahead.
I think that is still one place where newspapers are very powerful, particularly in a community this size. If you write a bad review of a restaurant, that could put the restaurant out of business.
Yes. And we recognize that. Or actually, if you write a good review, you can really hurt a place too. My friend, the restaurant critic, used to call up and say, hello, there's going to be a review in the Sunday paper. You may want to add extra staff because, and the restaurateur would not believe it. They'd say, oh, well, this is fine. And they would just be hammered with people coming in, especially if it's a favorable review. And everybody have a terrible experience and call the newspaper and say, oh, your critic was stupid.
There's a wonderful documentary that's aired on cable a few times about the legendary owner of Le Cirque in Manhattan. And they opened up a new restaurant or they renovated their place. But it culminates in the night of the opening and their understanding that the New York Times review is going to be coming up online at any time, and watching the owner in particular pacing, going back to the computer, waiting for that review, and that review finally coming up, and it not being nearly as good as he had hoped it was, demoralizing and angering the man. But it showed in that particular instance how important the New York Times review was to a restaurant of that quality in Manhattan.
That's
so there's still that going on. Yeah.
But the value of independence in all of the reporting is essential, and it's really hard when you're a beat reporter. If you're the reporter covering a county courthouse, for example, and you depend upon the DA's office to give you information, you depend upon your relationship with defense lawyers to know what's going on. Maintaining your independence is really a difficult thing because you have to keep going back to these people who you're ticking off. You have to keep going back to them time after time for information. So people don't, I think, recognize how hard that task is for a beat reporter.
When I started in sports and in the early 70s, it was not uncommon for me to call the Yankees. And bear in mind, I'm an upstate reporter who does not cover the team on a regular basis, but I could call the Yankees and say, I need 2 tickets tomorrow and get the 2 tickets.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't think twice about it, number one. But it also didn't impact the way I wrote about the team. I mean, in those days, the Yankees stunk. And we wrote about it. On the other hand, if I was a beat reporter, and in those days the dining room was free for the press and all that kind of things, you could lose access to players or the management in general. So you had to think there was at least a thinking twice by reporters in those days. I believe it's mostly changed now. But
I think there's still some free food in press boxes.
No, they charge you now.
Is that right?
I read all of the press guides, and I have a purine interest in looking. And on the page notes to the press, it talks about, here's where the dining room is, and here's what the there will be a fee for food. They all do it now.
Well, you know, to go back to travel writing too, for years you could not write negative things in a review, not because you're taking money from the hotel or whatever, but because that was an advertising site, mm-hmm. and you're getting lots of money from travel agents when they had such a thing, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to read negative bad news on those pages. So we were pressured to write happy thoughts mm-hmm. about travel. Mm-hmm.
Well, happy thoughts will dominate in a lot of reporting still, and will be grouchy still. Anyway, more of this to come, folks. The Media Project, the way to interact with us is media@wamc.org. We'd love to hear from you, media@wamc.org. Thanks for joining us. Ira Fussfeld, Rosemary Armeo, I'm Rex Smith. We'll be back next week with more, including the professor.
You've been warned.
Drafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ding-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.